How's it, everyone? This is Nate. I get to welcome you to the podcast and tell you about our sponsor for today, which is Oakley Standard Issue. Oakley Standard Issue is a division of Oakley specifically for serving those that serve government, military, law enforcement, firefighters, and EMS, the whole lot. Qualified members are going to get exclusive access to new products, service-related discounts, that's the big one, but a whole lot more. Products they're probably already known for is the eyewear. Their eyewear is ballistic rated and industrial certified, perfect for on the job. Footwear that meets uniform regulations while on duty, which is kind of a big deal. Some of my favorite boots I've ever had are the Oakley boots that I picked up when I was in Fort Bliss doing a ton of ruck marches there. Other accessories like gloves and backpacks, some of my favorite gloves I've ever had have also been Oakley gloves. Newly released off-duty styles and collections are definitely stuff that you want to head over and check out. Head on over to oakleysi.com to register. Then you can take advantage of our discount code, which is fieldcraft15 at checkout to receive an additional 15% off of your first order. Again, that is oakleysi, Sierra India.com. Built to protect. Make sure you head on over and check that out.
Hey guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Revolve podcast. We're going to get to the show in just a minute, but before we introduce our guest and get down to business, we got to recognize a few of our friends that make this totally possible. I want to recognize Sig Sauer, and that's the correct pronunciation, Sig Sauer. Sig Sauer is a leading firearms manufacturer, and they are the makers of one of my favorite firearms out there, which is the Sig MPX. Guys, Sig and I, we go way back. Sig Academy is the training branch of Sig Sauer. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. The first Sig pistol I ever purchased was an early Sig 226, which I stupidly sold. And I know that like DASA guns aren't as cool as modern striker fire pistols like the 320 or the 365. But man, that Sig 226 was a tank. And talking to buddies who are classic line armors, they say that you can rebuild those classic line pistols, the 220, 226, 225, 228, 227, 229. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. You can rebuild those over and over and over. So Sig is definitely a firearms manufacturer you want to take a look at. If you decide to go up to the training academy, you're going to get a chance to train with some of the best instructors in the world. And, you know, in this industry, I've met a bunch of cool guys, a bunch of tier one folks, and I've met some folks with some seriously, seriously bad egos. I will tell you that the instructors up at Sig, they just want to see students do better. And they'll say, here's one way to do it. Here's another way to do it. Here's three or four more ways to do it. Find the one that works the best for you. There's no such thing as a one size fits all answer up there. And like I said, I've enjoyed my time training up at the academy. So please check out SigSauer.com. Check out SigSauerAcademy.com. Take a look at all the cool stuff they have to offer. Now, this next industry partner, good friends of ours, it's Hoist. And right now, if you were to go into the Firebase, North Carolina Firebase refrigerator, you would see bottles of Hoist. Hoist has been kind enough to send us some of this good stuff, which really helps with rehydration. And out here in North Carolina, where the temperatures get really, really hot and humid, we see students all the time go from, you know, bright and alert to kind of haggard and a little like cloudy in the brain. Well, Hoist is one of those things, whether they're drinking the liquid version or they mix the powdered version of their drinks, it definitely helps bring them back. We're proud to, you know, represent Hoist. I have a Hoist banner up in our warehouse where we do our training. For the very reason I want people to just know about it. I swear by it. I mean, I'm a pretty active person myself. I also sweat like a pig. And after a good workout or training out here, good range day, where you just know you've lost pounds of water weight, Hoist is one of those drinks that definitely makes you feel better. So please check out hoist.com and take a look at all the drinks that they have. There's one of their drinks, which is like an orange mango one or a peach mango. It's either orange mango or peach mango. I just know it has a mango in it. And damn, that stuff is good. That's like the first one to disappear. And believe it or not, the watermelon one is really awesome. Like we've probably all had nasty watermelon stuff in the past. Well, the Hoist stuff is pretty darn good. Guys, check them out. Hoist.com. They are used by a lot of elite groups, the military, high performance athletes, you name it. And like I said, you are going to be pretty pleased when you see how you perform after you drink Hoist. Guys, the last thing I'm going to bring up, we've got some really cool courses coming up. We have a new guest instructor series. We have three instructors I want to point out to you guys. Jason Smith is coming to Fieldcraft Survival North Carolina in Aberdeen on July 29th. He was on the show Alone, The Beast. He's a former SEER instructor as well as a former SF dude. Solid guy. He's been on this podcast before, so check that one out. We also have Alan Odinson, who's doing primitive and traditional archery. Alan is basically a modern day barbarian. And if you look up Odinson Archery, you're going to see all the crap that he can do with that bow. Dude shoots fast. He's hilarious. Really, really good instructor. And even though he looks like a total badass, he's the nicest dude you'll ever meet. He's coming August 5th here to North Carolina. And the last one that we have currently on our site is probably one of the biggest names in the bow hunting industry, a legend in his own right, and that is Aaron Snyder. Aaron Snyder from Kafaru, another one of our good friends, one of the companies that I'm proud to represent and have been sponsored by for years. Kafaru, Aaron Snyder is coming out, and that is going to be November 9th through the 11th here in Aberdeen. That course is going to sell out quickly. There are only 10 or 12 spots, I think 10 spots available. So please come to that one. You're going to get 3 days of training with him. I'm going to be the AI for that course. It's going to be badass. So come and check it out. All right, guys, let's get down to this podcast. Here we go. Hey, guys, welcome to the Fieldcraft Survival Podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Estella. Guys, when you look up the word outfitter or when you go to an outfitter, you expect that there is going to be a person or a group of people that can equip you from head to toe, right? You expect that when you go to an outfitter, it's kind of like that outpost that we all remember from Red Dawn, the one where, you know, the boys, you know, get warm clothes and food and a whole box of arrows. And let's not forget that buck knife that slides across the countertop. And then next thing you know, they run into the woods and they're good to go, hiding away from the Russians and the Cubans in that amazing movie, which is the only Red Dawn. We will not recognize the one that came out with Thor. So I want to introduce you to a friend of mine who has an outfitter, and I'll tell you a funny story about how we met. Actually, we'll tell you the funny story of how we met, but this is Jay Pulaski, and Jay owns Yellow Birch Outfitters, which happens to be in my hometown of Bristol, Connecticut. So without further ado, Jay, how are you, buddy?
Hey, Kevin, how are you, man? It's good to hear from you.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you too. And yeah, you are in the hometown. I'm trying to think, was that 2017 that we first met, or was it 2018? It was...
I moved in there about 2017 after moving out of the house. And I think it was within a couple of months thereafter, you found my my post with the K&N match case.
Yeah, it was the K&N match case. I was just kind of going on, looking up like all the old school gear that I have, right? Like my True Nord compasses. I want to see if anyone is still selling True Nord. I was going on looking up the K&N match case that I picked up from LL Bean way back in the day. Like we're talking, this is like July or August of 1999. And then I look up online and I'm like, look at that K&N match case. It says hunting license, Connecticut. What store is this? And then to my amazement, I'm like, that is less than 2/10 of a mile from the house that I grew up in. I'm like, I got to meet this guy. So I just randomly messaged you and I'm like, dude, you don't know me, but you work near my childhood home. We got to talk. And the next thing you know, we meet up, you make me soup of all things.
Soup.
Yeah. You make me soup. Yeah. And then, we proceeded to build a pretty cool friendship. So let's kind of catch people up to what that business is all about and then talk about your background. So what the heck is Yellow Birch Outfitters?
So Yellow Birch Outfitters started as an idea to bring back something that used to exist that kind of doesn't in this Amazon laden get it today kind of world, where somebody would come to you with your needs. And I'm gonna take this back about 100 years and tell you the first expedition to Antarctica. Do you know who the outfitter was?
Was it Sears or was it Abercrombie or one of those?
It's Abercrombie and Fitch.
Hell yeah. Yep. Yeah. Look at that. History knowledge right there.
Yep, Abercrombie and Fitch. So back in the day, your outfitter, and we're talking from the days of Nessmuk right up until early Abercrombie and Fitch, the outfitter was kind of like your tailor for the outdoors. Somebody would say, hey, I want to go here. This is how long we're going to be going. This is what we need to do. Can you take care of it? And the outfitter would go and set up the routes, come up with the meal lists, come up with the equipment, make most of the equipment themselves, or contract the work out. And then at the end, you'd come back and everything would be ready for you and waiting, and you would just go on your adventure. And this is some of it, like I said, with Nessmuk predated cars, and it was the 10-pound canoes and all of these other things. But even through the days of car camping and early expeditions, that's what an outfitter does. And then as time progressed, the outfitter became more of urban outfitters. It was clothing, it was style, it was trends, it was things like that. But I kind of wanted to reclaim the idea, because even in the world of bushcraft that I kind of came out of this from, gear selection, gear needs and requirements and pack requirements were always something that was very individualized. You know, an off-the-shelf thing was good enough, but it wasn't always perfect. You know, new kit was coming out all the time, and people needed their individual ways to say, hey, I need this, this, and this. Can you give me a hand? And I wanted to bring that back, that service, that slow down, develop a relationship, and really deliver things that you can count on when you're out there mentality that seemed to have gone by the wayside in a lot of situations, not all of them.
Which is why you pretty much gave me soup when we first walked in. Instead of coffee, you know, you're like, here, have a bowl of soup. You know, check this out. Look at this product. I mean, it was pretty cool because, you know, I walked into your shop, which at that time it wasn't set up for retail, like walk-in or anything like that. But you invited me right in. You're like, hey, what do you think of these? What do you think of these? Hey, I get these. Check out this new fabric. Like, there's no doubt that what you just described from – you know, pre-automobile, you mentioned Nessmuk, which is kind of like a little fun pet project of mine. You know, I've been told that I shouldn't, you know, I shouldn't disrespect Nessmuk by saying that he was an alcoholic and a deadbeat dad, but hey, that's the truth. But Nessmuk was 105 pounds, right? Or 103 pounds and 5 feet tall. Yeah. And he carried a 10 pound canoe called the Sari Gamp. And he carried like a 15 pound backpack, and he could survive. But then you're like, well, how could he keep all of his gear so light? And then you're like, well, he was like a 5 foot tall dude, you know?
Yeah,
sure. So, I mean, you bring that up, and then you bring up all the other ways that, like, the Antarctic expedition, which I'm sure will make Glover really happy, you know, because he's a Antarctic, you know, junkie. But when you walk into your store, pretty much what you just described, like, you had coffee, you had food, you had all the materials to make leather pouches, Cordura organizers. I mean, you're even making that Peck Mountain field bag. Like, there's no doubt, like, if you wanted to, you could equip someone from your page, from your store, with everything that they need for a long weekend, a month, whatever, you know. And then you're into overlanding too. So, I mean, I guess the question that I should be asking is, you know, that was where you were. We eventually met, and now you're doing a lot of different projects. But in order to make those projects, the leather pouches, the Cordura organizers, all this stuff, you've got to develop that skill set. So how did you develop the skill set working with, you know, these textiles and whatnot? Because I thought it was really cool when we spoke, you were describing a like kind of like a project that you had where you would have people apprentice under you and you would teach these dying arts. Where did you learn them?
So I've always been the 80s do it all, you know, typical Gen X. I'm going to figure this out. You know, the path was a wide one. When I was in high school, I wanted to work in the movies doing special effects. And the closest internship I could get was working in the costuming department of the downtown cabaret theater down in Bridgeport across from the courthouse. And that was where I first learned how to operate a sewing machine. Forward that into a major in industrial design at the now defunct Art Institute of Pittsburgh. I learned how to do prototyping, and I learned how to do schematics, and I learned how to do patterning, and I learned all of that stuff. And post that, I found myself couch surfing. So I did what any desperate 18-year-old kid would do, and I called up my local recruiter and I enlisted. Mm-hmm. Ended up in the Army Infantry, where if you can beat it up, you're going to. My last duty station back in 2000-2001 was now Joint Base Lewis-McChord, but at the time it was Fort Lewis. with the 2nd Infantry Division. And we were the unit that was testing out a lot of the new MOLLE gear. And at the time we called them labs, but now they're called strikers. So it was our job to go out there and beat on things, you know? So I learned a lot about what design ideas worked, what design ideas didn't, where things would fail, why they would fail, how they would fail, how you could circumvent that. And combining that with what I had learned in art school about the simplicity of design and other features just allowed me to start coming up with ideas. Beyond that, it was just, let's try it out. Post-Army, I'm back home. And the whole business started because I was getting into bushcraft and I'm a lefty. And for all you lefties out there, you know that knife sheets don't exist. Not off the shelf with your knife anyway. So I've got this brilliant Puko and a sheet that's on the wrong side of my body. And I went, oh, that's no good. Let's see what a custom sheet costs. And then bushcraft was still predominantly a British pursuit at the time. I was starting to hit these shores, but it wasn't really there yet. So you had a couple of makers here and there, and the price of a sheath at the time was more than I wanted to part with. And I said, well, how hard can this be? And I discovered a Tandy just a few miles up the road and started doing what most people do these days, watching a couple of YouTube videos and picked up a couple of supplies and started hammering away and ruining things until I kind of figured it out. But I mean, I grew up a handy guy in a pretty blue-collar family. So if something needed to be done, you kind of did it yourself, you know, bending brake lines, fixing stereos, doing window screens. My father was always a hands-on guy. My mother was always a hands-on person. And so just learning and figuring it out was kind of always the mindset, you know. And I said, you were talking about the manufacturing that I used to do with a lot of the people that I used to help. I used to tell them, you know, if you've got the eye for detail, I can teach you the skill set. The one thing you can't teach is that eye for detail that's required to do the work, you know. But that's kind of where it came from, and it just evolved, and there's a lot of experimentation. And one of the key survival skills, you know, positive mental attitude. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think you can't do it, you can't. If you think you can, you can. That was Henry Ford's mentality, right? Whether you can or you can't, you're absolutely right.
Let's roll this back just a bit to your testing in the Army, because in this day and age of YouTube and Instagram and people that want that internet celebrity fame, you get a lot of gear testers. And
sure,
back in the day, I was a gear tester. I still consider myself a tester. You know, companies send me gear to try out and I'll do that stuff. You know, I'll use it and then I'll post feedback. And sometimes I'll do like the buzz if I'm in with the company and they want us all to release it at the same time. I'm guilty of that. But I've always believed that an authentic field test was vital for a gear test. And it seems like there are a lot of people that cheat their way around the authenticity because it takes time. It takes time. It takes effort. It takes, takes elbow grease. It takes getting your hands dirty. So my question to you, when it came to doing those tests for the military, number one, what was like the criteria for testing? Like, how did you establish like the parameters for a test? And then the second thing is, where do you see, like, how would you recommend a person test equipment today?
Well, I got to say that testing by one person is usually not completely effective. Mm-hmm. And I know that's kind of what you have today, because you have reviewers and they get the stuff and they put it through their test, but they're going to put it through their test the way that makes sense to them. When you hand new supplies to a platoon and you send them out in the field for 2 weeks and you're living out of these things and your flanking maneuvers in the woods and your assault and your drops and your rolls and your pack. I mean, when we were out there training, this was still, you know, relatively in the Alice days, you know, we would be out there with a full combat load. And as a saw gunner, that was, you know, roughly 120 pounds on an Alice pack with an assault pack strapped to it, a couple of Tootsie Rolls. For those not known, a Tootsie Roll is a cardboard 81 millimeter mortar tube filled with sand. And you'd carry a couple of those because we had a mortar squad attached to us. So everybody would carry a couple rounds for the mortar guys. So when you drop a pack off your shoulders because you've got to go into a full assault, you literally just fling it off and whatever's underneath, you don't even think about it because you're just on. So it wasn't really planned. It was, let's put these guys under field conditions for a couple of weeks and see what comes back. You know, as far as the criteria and stuff, I didn't have the pay grade for that. It was here, yeah, try this and hand it back when you're done. And I got to say, I envy the Army's assault packs now, because we had those god-awful, what were they, PX-90 or some random form of awful that I think was used to extract information from Op4, because they were horrible. But it seems to have worked, because things have gotten better.
You know, it's better. Interesting. We've definitely had discussions over the years about certain gear and how people are brand label sluts, right? Like, oh, I've got to have this because it's from that company. Or, sure, you know, people will say, I've got to have this particular caliber or this particular knife steel. And we've said that, you know, if you didn't tell a person what they were using and just said, focus on the results, right? Focus on the capability, right, focus on what that thing can actually do. You would be surprised that some of the materials, some of the designs that are from our generation, from the 80s, from the 90s, they're actually working better than the stuff that's out there today, because we've over-engineered the process. We've over-engineered the designs, and we're getting too far away from the field, which I think that's one of the things that I've always liked about you over the years, is that you go out there and do it yourself, and you're like, no, I tried it like this. I don't like it. I mean, we were screwing around that one time with that cross draw pancake style holster, or I should say sheath, for a multi-tool. Yep. And I was like, yeah, I wonder if you could put a fire steel in there. Cause you know, it's nice to have knife and fire steel.
Sure.
And then you were like, oh, I found that if I just tweak it a little bit, I can hold a multi-tool and a hex driver. And I'm like, that's awesome. Yeah. Like, but those ideas come from people that are actually users, and that's what you were. It sounds like when you were in the military, they didn't tell you what they were doing with the test. They just said, use it. And it was kind of like that blind test that we were just talking about.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, use 100%. It. And maybe like you're thinking when you're out there, hey, we're testing capacity. But they might be testing like a type of thread that they use to put it together. You know what I mean? Like, it could be something so innocuous.
Yeah. I mean, it was a really cool time to be out there, because at the exact same time I was at the 2ID testing all of this stuff, Tactical Tailor was in its infancy. And it was still the original owner pre-accident, God rest his soul. Mm-hmm. So he was fresh out of Hawaii and putting out his stuff. So you'd see his 3-day assault packs and his ruck mods starting to show up. So I'd be studying those on top of it, because, you know, as a private or a PFC at the time, I couldn't afford these things that the squad leaders were throwing on with the extra pouches and the extra pockets and the extra hip belts. So at the same time that I'm watching these other things fail, I'm watching these other things succeed. And it gave me this deep love and appreciation for Cordura, Thousand Denier Cordura. I swear by it to this day. If it's a fabric, it's going to be Thousand Denier Cordura, unless it's shorts, because that's probably uncomfortable. But yeah, so it was seeing somebody else coming from the same mentality. He was infantry down there, and I'm infantry up here, and my mind is bent on design, and his mind is bent on design. I was able to see approaches from a couple of different angles at the same time we're testing these things coming out of the military. So it really kind of converged in this idea. But I also prescribe this idea of, and it's one of the things that tends to put a lot of small businesses out. I build things to last. You know, I have this mentality of, if you're going to spend your hard-earned money on something that I'm making for you, it's something that should last. You know, a lot of these, and you were talking about these fly-by-night design mm-hmm. ideas where people are just putting in the cool guy, you know, and you see the faults in those designs, but they're meant to. You know, eventually you're gonna upgrade to the newest one. I like designs that tend to stand the test of time, where I'm hearing from repeat customers 7-8 years down the road saying, hey, it's still growing great, I just wanted a new color. And I mean, yeah, it doesn't lead to more in sales, but the end goal of my business was never to be huge. It was to take care of the guys that are doing the work. And when you have a mentality of taking care of your people, then you tend to think about the way designs last and the way designs work more than you do about how quick you can turn around a customer.
So let's talk about one of those materials that you didn't mention just yet. And that material is one that's near and dear to my heart. And it's one that you've used and you've actually made products for me out of it. And that's bridal leather. So let's talk about bridal leather. So I know that people out there, you know, when they think of leather, if they're listening to this podcast, they're probably thinking in terms of like the holster makers that are the big names in the gun shops. You walk in there, you find DeSantis, you walk in there, you find Galco. And then every once in a while, you'll find like one of those like Milt Sparks holsters where everyone feels it and they're like, whoa, like this is the one that you want to get your hands on. The leather that you use is from Wicked and Craig, which is the same supplier as Filson. And everyone knows Filson. Now, can we talk about the leather that you use and maybe kind of give the listener like a little explanation of, hey, this is what you should look for. This is what you should watch out for. You know, like kind of like give us like the hits, so to speak, like the best of, you know, the pros and cons of different types of leather that are out there. Cause that's your specialty.
So, when you're dealing with leather, the first thing you really want to understand is the purpose, right? Belts, tack, straps, holsters, sheets, things like that have a much different use than a garment leather, than a wallet leather, than a bag leather. You know, you're looking for different characteristics. And I fell on, I use an English bridal leather, which sounds antithetical to a leather company that's been making English bridal in Pennsylvania since before the Civil War, you know, which is one of the main reasons I turned to them over so many other bridal suppliers out there, is that they're using American labor, they're using American steers, they're using, it's 100% made in America. Wonderful leather. And English bridal leather is an old recipe where they hot stuff, which means heating up the leather and really imbuing it with oils and waxes. It was the original webbing. It was designed for horse tack in battlefield and outdoor situations when cars didn't exist and you were in a buggy with reins and straps, and the last thing you wanted was a piece of leather rotting out or letting go when that was the engine to your vehicle. So it was the original super material. It was webbing and duct tape all rolled into one wonderful, colorful thing that smells great when it gets hot. I really prefer it because it has a pretty firm hand. And for any of those who don't quite understand the properties of leather, I've always told people that working with leather is halfway between textile and carpentry. Right.
Amen to that. Sewing. One. And you can glue it. I said, amen to that one. Like you can glue it. You can shave it. Like you.
you can sand it. You can bevel the edges. You can go, you can sew at a 45 degree angle. You can sink nails on it. But at the same time, I can throw it under my sewing machine and sew the bottom of a bag. If I wanted to say like replicate one of the old Swiss rucks with that beautiful thick leather bottom to them. In the same vein. So English bridal has a really firm hand to it, meaning that the thicker it is, the stiffer it is. So it has wonderful uses for friction holding. I tend to not use it in things that you wet form, because in order to wet form leather, you've got to soak it. And if it's already imbued with oils and waxes, those are both hydrophobic substances. So in that case, I'll go to, you know, a standard veg tan. There's an important one right there. English bridal is a veg tanned leather, right? That cross section, when you see that tan, that is the color of the leather. When you see things like Chrome Excel or chrome tanned leathers, they're tanned with chromium salts and they come out looking like they're blue. And then they have to be dyed or bleached to the appropriate color. Vegetable tanned leather is the leather that gets that wonderful patina that takes on the oils from your use, the oils from your hands, and it starts to get that sheen that doesn't come from anywhere else. It ages the way natural material should, the way horn does, the way, you know, just the way natural materials tend to. It requires care, obviously, you know, with any leather product, but more so. The more it's used outdoors, the more you want to, you know, take care of it and re-add the oils and waxes back to it over time. It's another conversation. But in a thinner weight, it has an amazing strength to it while still keeping a pretty firm hand. So I can go down to say a medium weight 4 or 5 ounce, which has got a cross section of maybe 3/16, depending, and create a sheath that is going to mold and bend around your body, like those pancake sheaths you were talking about, mm-hmm. but still resist the bumps and bruises and bangs and scuffing that come with outdoor adventure, where some of these softer handed leathers tend to stretch or pull or come undone over time. So I'm a big fan of A, the manufacturing, B, the people who do it, and C, the longevity and reliability of the product. When I look at any material, I want to look at what it's going to do in 10 years, not what it's going to look like when it comes out of the box.
Back in 2020, I had earned the Jeff Cooper Legacy Foundation scholarship. So I went out to Gunsight and I shot out there. And at the end of that course, you get a chance to walk through Jeff Cooper's house, right? The sconce. And you get a chance to go through his gun room and you get a chance to see all of his gear. And it's very apparent when you're there, you see a combination of his pistols, his rifles. He has a whole tray like underneath all this stuff that has all of his knives that he collected over the years. But then there's another section of that gun room that's really important and it's really interesting. You see Jeff Cooper's leather and those guys, right? Like we're talking about the pioneers of the modern defensive pistol in America, pistol training in America, they valued their leather. And if you go back further to the lawmen of this country and the outlaws of this country, leather goods that they used, like to own leather and to have like quality leather, that was something that you cherished. You didn't just discard. Like I look at some nylon gear and I have like an old Eagle Industries A3 pack that I've had since 2001.
Yep.
And it's got history. It's got some stains on it that I'll never forget, but it just doesn't have the same character as like a quality piece of leather, you know, like a leather holster versus a nylon holster, a leather holster versus a Kydex holster. And granted, I primarily carry in Kydex, but there is something to be said about nice leather, you know, like whether it's for your barbecue gun or your hunting setup, whatever, you know, like there's something to be said about leather, man.
It's comfortable. Leather is incredibly, it gets a bad rap on holsters, especially in this day of appendix and inside the waistband carry as being a material that isn't as sturdy, but it's all in design consideration. I unfortunately can't really advertise on my website or anything, but I create holsters that use a truss system that's just a double piece of leather, and you can holster, unholster, and reholster inside the waistband without it collapsing, but it's still just as comfortable. You know, Kydex is fantastic, especially here in the sticky New England summers, and I know Carolina is the same way.
Yeah, it is.
The last thing you want to be doing at the end of the day is airing your firearm out until the leather dries and then trying to throw a little wax in there to massage the salts out of it.
You can pretty much say if you have to air your balls or if you have to sit in front of a fan or give yourself a fresh wipe because you got that swamp ass, that sour ass going on, you probably should be looking at Kydex for a holster material.
However, I've had more than a few sores on my hip from doing a lot in a day and having to pull a hunk of plastic out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I love what some of these companies are doing out there with the hybrids where you have the leather backing and then the Kydex front with the adjustable retention pulls and all that stuff. They make for incredibly comfortable combinations. Something I've been exploring lately with another local manufacturer up here. But there's room for innovation with tradition. I think a lot of people eschew the two as one being for the old people or the nostalgic and one being the way of the future or the way it is now. And you know, there's a lot to be said about, you know, marrying the past to the future. And you see it in the techniques that we use in survival and we use in woods bumming and woodsmanship. You know, modern steels have made Scandi ground knives something that's even more formidable. You know, I have that one you gave me that's a beautiful Scandi ground Mora on a S35VN. And it's a knife shape and technology that's 200 years old with a material that's, you know, 15. And
right.
In the right combinations, you know, learning from the past and adding it to the future, it always creates the best of both worlds, in my opinion.
Instagram, Facebook, all these different social media platforms, they've been relentless with you to the point where, I mean, at Fieldcraft, we talk about how we're censored and it's, I know people when they're like, I can't search you. I have to type out your full profile in order to get you. And then you're like the seventh person down the list. And I'm like, that's because they don't like that I've put up a picture of a Swiss Army knife. And then I get the restricted content posting weapons, right? Things like that. You've been tagged for your little pouches, the pockets. And they said weapon or dangerous goods. And I remember you posted it one time and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. But it's not just you. And I think this is part of a larger problem. I know Jason Gustafson from Lesser River Bushcraft, he's been nailed for weapons when he makes a hoodie. And other companies that make these accessories, even if like the slightest handle or hashtag that is also used in say like the second, you know, the 2A industry, the Second Amendment industry, the gun industry, if you put one of those similar hashtags, you get restricted immediately. They demonetize and they can hold your funds. Like, what was your experience? Because you said at one point Etsy came after you, right? They said you're not allowed to sell there. I mean, what was it?
So way back when, I moved out of Etsy around the same time that I moved out into my own site, about the same time I moved into my shop. Etsy was having issues with what you could post, who you could post it to. They were really trying to tailor their brand image at that time. And it was a pretty tumultuous time to do it. But I was running into issues where they would refuse to promote my products and eschew it for their own audiences. I don't know how politically you want me to wax
on. You can do whatever you want. Guess what? This is not Instagram.
So Etsy, even on Father's Day, was promoting women's products. Mm-hmm. And as a guy who made things for guys, you would figure that even on Father's Day, they'd say, hey, let's capitalize on this market. But they didn't, you know, they would prevent me from listing a knife, but promote somebody selling double-ended sexual desire devices. You know, I won't really get too far into that unless you specifically ask me about it. But it was this double standard where the idea of self-reliance was frowned on, but the idea of sexual freedom was lauded as bravery.
All I gotta say is the 12-year-old boy in my head right now, you said, I don't want to get too far on this thing. And I'm like, oh my God, that's what she said. You're talking about double standard and double ended things. Like, I'm just going to shut the hell up right now and just let you keep talking.
Yeah. It was getting pretty rough, you know, and I had a friend of mine who, in order to keep his business alive, and he did brilliant work, he had jumped into this market to try and capitalize on it. And good for you, you know, but I've always been prisoner to my own moral compass, and I will never forsake my integrity for a dollar. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to the values that I hold, and I'm pretty traditionally conservative leaning libertarian, the idea of morality is in everything that I do, and everything that, even though some of the jokes may border on the darker side of that, thank you, Army. as far as what I espouse and what I try to do, it holds pretty blue collar hardy boy America. So I saw the writing on the wall. You know, they were starting to charge more for less and really push to an audience that wasn't doing much for me. And I've heard of other brands jumping ship afterward. And today, I was actually on Etsy the other day, and I noticed that at the bottom of each listing page, they're promoting other people who are selling similar items, quite possibly for less, at the bottom of your listing, which tells me that Etsy is for Etsy and not for its creators. Right. Mm-hmm. They're all for. So I jumped when I did, and I jumped into Shopify, which has been a 75 out of 100 home. You know, as long as I stay in my lane, they are Canadian owned. And because of that, they have shut down any website that deals in firearms or accessories, which is why, as I alluded to before, I can't list my holsters on my website. Going in further to what you were saying, Meta has been the biggest thorn in my side for a long time. And at some points, I know it probably seemed a little George Costanza complainy, but if somebody wasn't pointing out the absurdity of the standards and enforcement in there, it was one of those, let's point to it and see what happens. I am permanently banned from paying for ads in there, in any Meta platform. I cannot pay to advertise any of my products, any of my posts, because they believe that I sell weapons and dangerous items. And I've tried to appeal the fact that, yeah, the biggest seller that I have is a fabric organizer. And if I just put a picture of an empty fabric organizer there, everybody's going to go, oh, that's cool. When you demonstrate, right? You show them how it can be used. You show them what gear fits. But in doing that, even though I'm only making the organizers, I now sell and promote dangerous weapons, which means Meta isn't going to do any trades with me unless I have some sort of basketball player that smoked pot in my house in a prison somewhere.
Let's talk about what you do sell, though, because I think there is a value to what you have, and I think there is something to be said about what you carry. And you are definitely in the everyday carry community. You're definitely in that genre because you have those pockets, you have those pocket yep. organizers, you have the field bags, you have that whole collection of sheaths, and then you have notebook covers, and you carry a handful of books, and you carry, you know, cooking gear, and there's the reviews. I mean, you have, I'm looking at your site right now. Right now, you're just shy of 1,300 reviews, and yep. your star rating is like 4.5 or 4.8 stars. Like it's significant. And there's no doubt that when people get those organizers, they love them. Go ahead.
Oh, no, finish what you were saying.
I was going to say, we've given away those organizers as contest prizes, like in survival yep. classes or land navigation classes. It's like, here, you just want a Yellow Birch Outfitters pouch. And people are like, yeah. Oh my God, I've seen these. I've wanted one. I can't believe I have. Like, people freak out. Like, they're very pleased with what you do. And then, of course, I mean, you've got other stuff, like not just the gear that you make, but stuff that you believe in. And you got me turned on to those little Spyderco pocket stones, only $15. That thing sharpens all my knives.
Nobody knows they exist.
Yeah.
Nobody knows they exist. Best pocket stone I've ever owned.
Yeah. So, I mean, like you've got all this gear that you recommend, and there's not one mention on your website of use this for, you know, ill intent. It's all the style and what you're going for. What you're trying to get people to do is go out into the great outdoors the way that people did when they would seek out an outfitter back in the day, and they wanted to get away from the hustle and bustle, and they just wanted to go sit by a campfire, or they just wanted to spend a night in the woods. Like, that's the vibe that your company gives off. And it blows my mind that something that could help families by going and getting good time together, or help people become more capable, like in the same mission that we have, where it's like, carry the gear that makes you the hero of your own story if something bad happens to you, where you can rescue yourself. People yep. don't want that. It's like there's like a collective effort to tell you, don't be as prepared or rely on someone else. It blows mind.
I gotta say, I don't think, and this is what you're seeing a lot, and here's where we're gonna start leaning into the political. I think people want it. I think people want self-reliance. America and Americans are all very wonderfully stubborn people. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to be reliant. They want to be self-reliant. They want to be able to take care of things. The ones who don't are the ones that tend to be the loudest. But my daughter and I, who is a wonderful woman, have had many conversations where we'll start hemming and hawing at each other about opposite sides of the spectrum. And she said to me once, she says, listen, the people in the middle are the ones you don't hear from. And I went, you know, you're absolutely right. You know, they talk about the silent majority. And those are us that have a pocket, that bought a pocket that they've had for 5 years. And in it is a little AAA flashlight, a good Swiss Army knife, and maybe a Parker jotter. You know, a couple mm-hmm. of Band-Aids, a pair of tweezers, and some nail clippers. And that goes in their pocket. And they get up, they make their lunch, they jump in their pickup truck, they go to work, they work their butt off to make America a little bit better. And then they come home and you know, lather, rinse, repeat. You know, the people that you tend to hear from the most are the ones who push the edges. And I don't mean the boundaries. I mean the edges, the far-sighted opinions. The, you know, you've got the Randall knife straight to the gas station knife. You know, you've got the titanium frame lock $1,000 piece, and then you've got the $35 tinker. And the average person is somewhere in the middle. And I think they really want that self-reliance, but the media wants to push a different message. They want to push rampant consumerism. They want to push micro trends. They want to push an idea of leaning on a centralized power to provide. The government called it cradle to grave, you know, and that's antithetical to what Americans actually stand for. You know, there's a lot of us out there that just want to get a little grease on our hands and come home smiling because we did it, you know. So they're out there. They may not know how to access things, and companies and platforms tend to try and prevent it, but you know, they end up finding things eventually, a little slower than some than they'd like to sometimes. But I really firmly believe that the majority of Americans out there are absolutely wonderful blue collar folk that just want to get the job done.
Bonjour, mes amis. Ça va bien? Welcome, everyone, to the Phil Crouch Revival Podcast. This is Nate, and if that didn't make sense, don't worry, it'll make more sense here in a second when I get to introduce the sponsor for today, which is Babbel, a language learning app. There's not a ton that I nerd about super hard, but learning languages is definitely one of them. I got to have really cool experiences traveling the world, meeting people in different countries and different militaries, and I always enjoyed trying to build rapport with them by speaking to them in their language. And fast forward to today, you know, it's still a huge interest of mine in the daily habits that I try to curate. You know, with things like working out, I try to spend 5 to 10 minutes every day learning a language. Right now I'm doing French, German, and Spanish. For where I live, I get to speak Spanish with lots of people, which is really cool. French is something that my son and I are learning together, which has been a fun way for us to connect. And ever since I was a teenager, checking out CDs from the public library and throwing them in my Walkman, trying to repeat common phrases. And then I found out that just using common phrases is not always a super effective way to have real conversations with real people. I have always wanted a tool, something that I could do it all with, which is Babbel. Babbel was developed by 150 different language experts, and they have people from Yale researching and trying to make it better all the time. My favorite part about Babbel is their custom coaching. And if you have a trip coming up in 3 months and you want to be so proficient with the language, you tell them how much time you need, or how much time you have to be able to do it, and then create a program for what you need to do every single day to meet that goal. For me, doing different languages, mine are super laid back, and I don't have a trip coming up in 3 months, so I don't have to worry about that. I love their pronunciation coaching. It's actually super pretty spot on, and for someone like me who pronounces things wrong all the time, I love to be able to try to learn it ahead of time correctly instead of having someone correct me real time and tell me that I said something super inappropriate. So that's super cool. I love how clean the interface is. I'm given one problem at a time, and it's a great way just little by little to be able to get the recall and the intervals that I need to actually feel like I'm making progress, but not overwhelmed all at the same time. So here is a special limited time deal for our listeners to get you started right now. Get 55% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/fieldcraft. Get 55% off babbel.com/fieldcraft, spelled babbel.com/fieldcraft. Rules and restrictions may apply. Danke y hasta luego. On to the show.
And I agree with you on that one. I think, like, I just traveled down to Palm Coast, Florida, and I talked to people the whole way. Like, I'm the guy that's in the airport, and, you know, if I'm having a good day, you know, I'm just going to strike up a conversation with the lady working at the newspaper stand, so to speak, like the magazine store that you always go into when you're in the airport. Like, I think people are just good people. They want to talk. And I think on like a individual level, it's so easy to just connect with folks. I want to talk.
I think more people should do that.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know what? I also was in the airport shuttle today, and I'm sitting around, like, I had a good rest on the flight back, and, you know, I'm all energized right before I got here today. And, you know, I'm looking around the airport shuttle. Everyone is on their phones. Like, family members are on their phones. Like, they just got done with the vacation, and I don't know if they're looking at photos. They could do whatever they want. But, you know, I remember the back in the day, like, when you were on the shuttle, you were talking about, man, I can't wait to go on the next vacation, or, man, how awesome was that? Like, you talk the whole time, and it seems like people now are just so deep into their devices, which, I mean, that's
I urge everybody out there to break that. You know, there's going to be people that stare at their phones because they don't know what to do. We've never been more connected, but less connected at the same time.
Yeah.
And I told you before, I'm studying now to be a pastor, and I make it a personal mission of mine to speak to people, to get to know people. And I usually break the ice with a dad joke because I've been a dad longer than I haven't. And my kids roll their eyes and I tell them, listen, a groan is just a laugh in reverse. You know, but it breaks the ice. It drops shoulders. It makes people more comfortable. But everybody out there wants to talk. I just think a lot of them don't know how to. And I urge everybody to normalize conversation again. You know, break into somebody on the phone. Make a comment about something. You know, start talking. Normalize the way America used to be. Because if nobody does it, then whoever's trying to make America what it is going to win.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Let's talk about a passion of yours, because it's a passion of mine, and it's something that ties into what you make and what you do and what you believe in. Let's just talk about everyday carry, because I know you've got your preferences. I know you've got your favorites. I'm going to talk about everyday carry, because at one point you were like, there's the holy trinity of everyday carry.
Yes.
And just can you kind of explain that? Because I've got my daily duo, but you've got your holy trinity. So talk about the trinity of daily carry.
So it's kind of expanded, but I consider the thing that goes in my pockets every day, the Trinity, is a pen, a knife, and a light, right? It's the basis of society. It's just what you need. When I worked as a manager at a Radio Shack way back in the day, people would come in and ask me for a job application, and I would hand them one. And the minute somebody said, do you have a pen, I wouldn't hire them. It told me that if they didn't have a pen, they weren't prepared for life. But if you weren't prepared for what you're about to come in for, you're not going to be prepared to handle everything that goes on in the day. I want to see somebody who's a self-starter and a little put together. So if somebody, you know, the pen was the first thing, besides which, you know, who wants to touch the same BitClick that some person just picked their nose and signed their name to? You know, I'm not a germaphobe per se, but if I'm going to handle something and write my name on, I want to know that it came out of my pocket. And as an artist, I kind of have a little predisposition to the way that things write and feel, and I enjoy the tactile experience of it. On top of which, talking from a purely self-defense method, a good titanium pen makes a fantastic coup de batte. You know, so even a Sharpie marker is fantastic, even without that weird thing, spike thing that they stick in them. But a pocket knife is another one of the same things. And it doesn't have to be a paramilitary two or some of the more extravagant ones. You know, in fact, I'm going to go against the grain here and say that if a knife costs more than you can afford to comfortably lose, you shouldn't have it. If you want to keep it as a safe queen, that's fine. But I can't bring myself to carry anything that costs more than, say, a paramilitary two, you know, because you've got to be willing to lose a tool. In the right circumstances. So a good knife, and I tend to favor it. Carbon steel. I love GEC. I love Old Case. I love the way carbon steel sharpens, how quickly it resharpens. I love the patina it gets. I love it. It's a piece of pocket jewelry. It's a fidget stone. It's a worry stone. If you can take and put one thing in your pocket that's both useful and gives you a smile every time you pull it out, even on a bad day, that's something that should be with you. There's something to be said for having a partner, something in your pocket like that. And in a light, you know, again, it doesn't have to be anything massive. And everybody's going to say, well, I've got my iPhone. Oh, sure, you have your iPhone, but your iPhone has one battery and its primary response should be the communications. If you can carry something that's not much bigger than a AA battery and it gives you 20 hours of light, why wouldn't you? I use, as a father, I've been a father for 28 years now. I use my light to fish more things out of corners and backpacks and look at splinters than I do just about anything else as a human. You know, I'm perpetually, oh, what's in the bottom of my bag? All right, honey, where in your purse? Where'd you drop the key? Oh, what fell under the car seat? Oh, my dog's ball went under the couch. Just a light is so immensely useful. Oh, we blew a fuse. You know, there's just no reason to not with the size that they're at today. And even, you know, Surefire and Streamlight have those wonderful integral battery ones. I know you're a big proponent of one, and I one day I'll get my hands. I think even Olight's coming out with one now. you know, flashlights back in our day. You know, the ultimate EDC flashlight was a 3D cell mag light, right?
And, oh, yeah.
And now you can get something that's turbocharged that fits well within the palm of your hand that would blow that well out of the water. You know, so I always considered those three the necessities of your basic day. And that's where the original pocket came from. The original pocket is the original classic, three slots in the front. You know, the slash was so that everything fit for each size, because your pen's going to be longer than your knife and that little light's going to be shorter than the knife. So a diagonal slash made everything fit nice. And then there was a little bit in the back for a boo-boo kit for the other two things that I find most useful. I have a set of pocket tweezers and Victorinox, the little nail clippers that fold up nice and slim, a couple of Band-Aids, a couple of dollars, you know, but my penchant for carbon steel meant that I didn't want them made out of leather, because again, leather in a pocket in summer is a sponge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my holy trinity. You've gone a long way towards putting me towards the daily duo.
Yeah, man. Yes.
I think one of the things you and I bonded over, you pulled out your Swiss Army knife. I'm like, that's a Ranger. Like, nobody knows the Ranger. Five layers of brilliance.
Yep. Fits the hand perfectly.
Yep. If you take that parcel hook and you bend it past the spring so that it's leaned out, I always took a stone to that area and I gave myself those 90 degree corners, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is the perfect flint striker.
Yeah.
If you're doing it right, right?
You know,
push the knife down, you pull the striker back, but yeah.
Mid 2000s, early 2000s is when you started seeing so many bushcraft knives with the added fire steel loop. You look at mm-hmm. all the bushcraft knives before that, and you look at the folks that were in the bushcraft community, you saw that they didn't have anything. They just ran their knives, their sheaths slick, and yep. they carried ferro rods elsewhere. I don't know who it yep. was or what it was that brought on that movement, but for the longest time, that's how I carried my knives, whether it was the Fox River. I had a Fox River and a Light My Fire Army Fire Steel. And that was like how I rolled. Yep. And it was knife and fire steel, Like,
yeah,
that
those
was
were
it.
Good.
So yeah. sometime, when was it? It was early last year. I was like, you know, I've been carrying a Swiss Army knife with a ferro rod on either like a micro S beaner or whatever it was. Like I always had a ferro rod attached to my Swiss Army knife. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. I don't have the ferro rod attached to the lanyard of my fixed blade. Why am I carrying it this way? And like, I was already carrying my Swiss Army knife inside of a Cordura nylon pouch that
yep.
Victorinox made. I'm like, I'm just going to make a leather one. I'm a leather guy. I'm going to make leather pouch. So I made one.
Yep.
And then we were talking and I forgot the exact way that it happened, but I was like, dude, how about you do this? And you did it and I did it. And then I sent you the template that I made, a photocopy of it. And then you took a ruler to it and you're like, you and I are exactly the same. You used the same measurements yeah. I did. Like, and there were a couple minor little tweaks. Like I did a radius or I did like a sharp angle. You did a radius, whatever it was. But you're like, we created the same product.
That was my week of COVID. That was, I was trying to come up with something to hold a fire steel and an Opinel number 8.
Yeah.
And I was kind of channeling the neck carry, but I also wanted a pocket thing. And I came up with that. And then you and I went back and forth. You flattened the bottom, which was definitely a cooler way to go about it than the big radius. And then I had it set up when I had measured it out and built it. It was three pieces, right? You had the top, the bottom. And then I had this mentality of taking a leather thong and skiving the edges and sticking in. You went, no. Make it one piece. It's cleaner. And I went, oh my God, send me your pattern. And I mean, dimensionally, when they were done, I put one up against the other. I took my calipers and I measured the inner diameters and we were spot on.
It's funny how that works.
That making it out of one piece was definitely, again, simplicity is elegance in design. And you had absolutely nailed it. And I went, well, let's do something with this. And you were like, yeah.
and it's cool. It's cool because I know for a while the guys over at Blade HQ, they ordered a bunch and they sold them.
Yeah.
And you know, I've seen students in classes as recently as last weekend. I had a kid named Pedro who used to be a former Brazilian basketball star. He shows up and he reaches into his pocket and he pulls out the Yellow Birch Outfitters Estela Daily Duo with a Ranger And with the Exotac fire rod, I was like, dude, you are my star student. Like, it was so cool that he had the exact everyday carry that I recommend. But you've got a couple other, like, really, I won't say quirks, but like, I know you like titanium and you like, it's not Fly Titanium. What's the company that does the small box cutter that you like?
Big Eye Design.
Big Eye Designs. Yeah, they make a pretty badass box cutter, and then they make a really nice pen. And like, what else? What else is in your like everyday carry quirk?
The core is typically like the Big Eye Design Tie EDC Ultra, I think it's called. Sorry, Chad McMahon, if I mangled that. I hope you're listening. They make fantastic products. And by the way, Mr. Carolina, they're just over in Chattanooga.
Are they really?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I think they were just dropping some teasers on something coming out. And from the crown that I saw, I think it's going to be a titanium watch, which I definitely want to check out. But I liked, again, as an artist, I'm a big fan of fountain pens, and I wanted something that could go between. And the Ultra was a screw cap pen, not a clicky pen, because I don't like blue pockets. But I could switch between a fountain pen when I felt like it and a regular. It works like a drill clutch. So there's stuff, they have this drill clutch design that no matter what pen insert you stick in there, it clamps down on it and it doesn't wiggle. Like, you ever write and you hear that click 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 mm-hmm. click click because the pen tip is wiggle, their stuff doesn't, and I absolutely adore that about their design. The drill clutch idea is absolutely phenomenal. Again, tweezers, I like pocket tweeze because they fold up, but they're hand ground tips, so they're great for splinters. They're great for anything that you would need, you know, precision tweezing for. The Victorinox nail clippers. I've got an off. I subscribe very much to the ABC carry. You know, what's in my pocket should get me to my bag. What's in my bag should get me to my vehicle. What's in my vehicle should get me back home. Right. So I have everything that I need. I typically have a lighter on me. I'm a big fan of the Dunhill Rolagas because it's the least threatening but most durable lighter I've ever had the fortune of owning. It's a little square, uses a traditional flint, butane filled, but there's no plastic. Like, these things were engineered to the nth degree. They made them right up until the 80s in various forms. They've got a capacious tank and everything's machined, right? There's a couple of O-rings that need to be replaced once every two decades, you know? So I always have one of those on me. A wallet with, you know, pistol permit and all of that jazz, comb because I don't like my chin, so I hide it behind facial hair. You know, I found a buddy of mine turned me on to these EDC tourniquets. I don't know if you've seen them yet. They're an inch wide. They're based a lot on the cat design.
Yeah.
But they're made out of inch wide webbing, which is probably as slim as I would go to be able to get adequate pressure to stop arterial bleeds. But they seem to be really effective and they pack nicely. Again, that's to lead me to my bag where I have a full blowout kit, you know, a handkerchief. You know, handkerchiefs have a myriad of uses for anything from basic coarse filtration to packing a wound if, God forbid, you needed to. I mean, the obvious blowing your nose or wiping something off your hands to char cloth if you were stuck in a situation and required to make some. So, you know, a good hunk of cloth is always a good thing to have. And then that leads me, you know, back to the bag where I have those beautiful North by North wool scarves that you turned me on to.
Yeah, which that company is out of business now.
I know.
Sadly. I know. Another one yeah. Went the way of the dodo. And I thought Chad did some great work, but
I have two of them, I'm happy to say. I've got one that I use all the time and I've got one backup for like 30, 40 years from now because he had the same mentality. Let's make something that lasts. Unfortunately, that tends to kick out a lot of companies because they get too good at doing it and people buy it and then they don't need to, right? Which means, yeah, you did your job, but it's a bit of a catch-22. Other things, firearm, definitely Pro 2A. It's tougher and tougher to be up here in the great prison state of Connecticut and New England. They're working on it. The upper part of New England is doing great. Go Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. But I always have some sort of firearm on me with a spare magazine because spare magazine. I think that's probably it for the most part as my on person EDC. A good watch, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. Moving to the bag, it gets a lot more involved as a photographer and an EDC guy. But that's the basis of what's on my person. I have that. I have kits, but nothing pocketable. I don't know how far you want to go with that.
Now, before we get off this podcast, because I got to jump on a marketing meeting, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Before we get off, you're definitely in the overlanding community, and your Jeep is hooked
working
up.
On it, yeah.
You're working on it. Yeah, your Jeep is your Jeep is hooked up. So for the gearheads in the room, and for those that wanted to kind of mimic your Jeep, what would they need to do? Because you've got the jerry cans. You were doing rooftop tenor. You thought about it, right?
So I had one. I ended up taking it off because off-roading is illegal here in Connecticut. In order to really get out, I had to get to Vermont or I had to get out to Pennsylvania, and it was sucking up gas. So I took it off for now, and I want to revisit that and get a hard shell. As somebody who's you know approaching 50 years and was not kind to my person, folding and unfolding that tent by myself was a little bit more than it allowed me to enjoy. You saw me the day we were teaching that Land Nav course. So I want to revisit that. But yeah, there's the jerry cans. There's an ARB 10-foot awning down one side, which I'm hoping to eventually replace with something that's 270 degrees. In the back, I've got a full goose gear setup with the slide out for a fridge and a propane stove. Cook Partner out of Idaho, Go USA. Fantastic stoves. Definitely worth the scratch. And then the stove that I have, or the fridge that I have, I wish I'm drawing a blank on the name, but they have a proprietary compressor that only has one moving part, right? They come out of Florida, but these things have been used in Australia since the 60s and people are still using their original ones. So it's very, very easy, very, very low power, very low maintenance. Redid the front with full dual yellow top batteries that can jump one off the other with a 12 volt line running straight to the fridge in the back. We've got a snorkel, a River Raider snorkel, which is a much lower profile design that uses a bell housing that comes up right in front of the Jeep instead of that piece of plastic that comes out the side. And I'm a big fan of that because those Ram Air ones tend to grab a lot of bugs. And here in New England with the smaller trails and the thicker trees, they tend to grab those things and they like to break them. So that little bell housing is more like what they have on the Humvees that I was used to seeing, but they sell an extension pipe. So if I really decided that I needed to, you know, drive to Germany from here, you know, it's a much more plausible, not that it's plausible. But, what else is in there?
You've got those side mounted steps, right?
Yeah, that's right. I've got the Smittybilt steps on the sides. Put in a lift kit 2 inches so I can put 33s. Again, everybody likes 35s and 37s, but here in the East Coast, trees hang low. So anything more than 33, you got a better chance of smacking, you know, when you're already running almost 9 foot with a 2-inch lift in a roof tent. Plus, it gets you most places that you need to know, you know, some 33s and a couple inches. Front and back bumpers, winch. Again, I'm a big fan of the steel cables. And I tell everybody, again, here in New England, you ever seen a tow truck with a fabric cable? Like, now they all run steel here because they're more with the weather changes and humidity changes and the rains and the snows and the ice, they're a lot more durable than the modern counterparts. And all you just have to make sure you put a weight blanket on the line so that, God forbid, there's a snap, it goes to ground and doesn't, you know, pull a slicing motion across wherever you're going. I'm looking out the window at it now. KC lights. I'm a big fan of KC, and I have those wired up to a wireless switch system because the new JLU only has one real point of egress through the firewall, and that point only exists if you have an automatic, and I have a stick. So this system allowed me to wire everything to a hub that's under the hood and then have a touch panel control inside. I have one of the Garmin little mini locators that I turn on when I'm going on adventures because I can disconnect it and put it on my pack if I'm going. It allows me to keep in touch with my family, allows me to keep in touch with emergency services because, you know, getting out there is one thing, but calling for help is not weak. God forbid you get in over your head. You want to make sure you get home, and having a safety net's always a good thing. Plus, it calms your brain a little bit and lets you really enjoy things a bit more. I keep four chairs for the family, a fold-up table, a full toolkit with an Atlas 99 bag. Love that company. If anybody is looking for a bomb-proof field tool bag, oh my God, they do it well.
That's the old Eagle Industries, right?
Atlas 99. I think they had something to do with them.
Yeah, yeah. I think they make the Legacy pack. Yeah,
I absolutely love it. ARB dual pump compressor system. Yeah, the basics. I've got two Yeti loadout boxes in the back instead of having the other drawer system, so that I had a little more room. One is all recovery gear. The second one is a field kitchen, but they also work as great steps or tables if you need them to. I think that's about it. I use a 67 Designs mount system. So I've got one arm running for my phone, one arm running for the touch panel, and one arm running for the Garmin, all sitting on top of my dash. And I've been on some pretty dicey terrain with this Jeep, and that is the most solid phone mount I've ever used. If you're anybody who goes off road, you're going to be using Onyx Trail, or you're going to be using any of the other navigation systems. And the last thing you want when you're trying to navigate a dirt road is to have your display bouncing. So the more rock solid you can make that, you know, the better you're going to be able to see what you're doing and take care of business.
Man.
But that's all on a late 2018, because they split the year. First half was JK, second half was JL, JLU, Wrangler.
Yep. Not bad, man. Well, hey.
No, it's been a fun build.
Yeah, it's been cool watching it from afar. And then seeing it, you know, when I have stopped by, when I was back in Connecticut, you know, popping in, you know, seeing it in the parking lot, I'm like, oh, he just added that. He just added that. But I mean, Lego, yeah. I mean, basically Jeeps are Legos for adults, you know, kind of
Jeeps and Glocks, man. They're Legos for big people.
Yeah, damn right. So where can people find you? Because I'm sure there are going to be folks that want to support a good business. They want to see what you're doing, where you're headed, and, you know, keep up with the new products that are coming out.
I appreciate that. And anybody who has any ideas or designs that they want done, half the fun of this is doing the custom work. So don't be afraid to ask. But I'm at yellowbirchoutfitters.com, all one word, at yellowbirchoutfitters on Instagram. And that tends to pop over to Twitter and Facebook. I tend to post mainly on Instagram just because it filters through to the other ones. So you can find me at yellowbirchoutfitters on Instagram, yellowbirchoutfitters.com, all one word. Phone 860-552-6678 Eastern time, please. 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. And then messaging on the website.
Damn, man.
I look forward to anybody who wants to come check out the work. Anybody who wants to keep themselves organized to just get things done. Anybody who trusts good old fashioned American made work by a vet. And anybody who wants anything custom, they have an idea for something, you know, the Daily Duo was one of those. The Pocket was one of those. They all start off as somebody says, hey, what if? So I love what if.
Hell yeah, man. Well, I love it. I'm so happy that we connected over the years. And,
yeah,
you know,
too.
I'm sure next time I'm in Connecticut, I'm going to swing by. We'll have to have more soup. And, you know,
they're going to be asking about this soup, man.
Yeah. And then we got to get you down here in North Carolina at some point to meet up with one of these guys. Like, it's only a day's drive. You know, there's some pretty good.
Used to go to school down there.
Yeah. And there's some pretty good overlanding and off-roading in Uwari. So we'll get you down here at some point, but I appreciate the heck out of you coming on the podcast today, brother.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. It's been great catching up. It's been great talking. It's been great letting people know what's going on out there.
Hell yeah. Well, I'm going to jump on this meeting, unfortunately. And I hope you. Yeah. And I hope folks, you know, head over to your site. But guys.
Me too. If not, everybody take care of themselves. God bless you. And God bless America.
Damn right. All right, guys. This has been the Field Craft Survival Podcast. Thank you for listening.